So go ahead with the intro and hope he shows
Love
up.
Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Steve Rubell. Steve is Chief Content Strategist and former EVP of Global Strategy and Insights for Edelman, the world's largest independent PR firm. In his current role, Steve is responsible for creating and cultivating best practices in content strategy and for piloting innovative media partnerships that blend paid, owned, and earned strategies. During his tenure with Edelman, Steve has served in a number of senior advisory roles. He helped evolve both the firm's thinking and strategy around the rapid advances of social media and, more recently, disruptions in the broader media landscape. Prior to joining Edelman in 2006, Steve worked for 15 years in a variety of marketing communications positions in corporate, nonprofit, and small mid-sized PR firms. Steve also acts as a highly visible Edelman thought leader and writer on media technology and digital culture. He's also been included in PR Week's 40 Under 40 and the Forbes.com Web Celeb 25. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hello.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve, I want to start by talking about a comment that you've made about your role with Edelman, which is that you said your job is to see around corners. Can you explain what you meant by that and how exactly you do that?
Well, I have to admit, it's a unique role, and I'm privileged to be in it. Edelman, just by way of background, is a 62-year-old family-owned company, and it has a long track record for really being kind of on the cusp of cutting-edge trends and ideas, and being fearless in their embrace of them. And that goes through many different iterations over the years. I mean, you know, we wanted the first large PR firms to open up an office in China, and you know, it was unheard of. And not long after Tiananmen, the history's got the firm's got a long history of doing that. And about 10 years ago, our executive team at the time was, starting at the top with our CEO, was very interested in. At the time, what was blogging and really becoming kind of a new democratized form of communication,
mm-hmm.
and he went and hired about 4, 5, 6 of us whose sole job it was to be thinking about this and to making sure that our team and our organization was creating the right conversations with our clients about these topics and engaging them in a very thoughtful way with research and so forth. So the firm has a DNA of kind of being fearless about new ideas and being in front of those ideas. And so I was brought on to kind of be in one area specifically, kind of a harbinger of what's to come and at the time, I mean, a lot of us forget that, but social media for a lot of corporations in its early days was a scary thing.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I mean, they were very fearful of it in the mid-aughts, in the mid, you know, in 2005, 06, 07, 08. It was a scary idea for them. And recent history makes it easy to forget that. Because if you're not on social media now, it seems more quaint than ever.
Absolutely.
But my job was specifically go be smart about social media, make our, as part of a team, help make our broader network, which at the time was about 2,000 people, smarter about social media, and let's start doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
And my background was I was one of the first kind of PR people, in, at least in the PR industry, to run a social media program about 10 years ago in a different firm. So my but, you know, much the same, I had to evolve my own role as well and kind of find the next thing. As, you know, eventually social media became so large that, you know, we have 1,000 people here at Edelman who whose job it is to provide social media strategy and counsel, and whether it be in a standalone capacity or as part of a larger program. And so I had to kind of think about what's the next thing that I'm going to focus on. And around that same time, I began to really notice that the media was going through, well, certainly they had been going through a lot of disruption over the years, but I just noticed that the way that reporters were doing their job was very different than it was even 2 years before. And I also started to see that the way the media was trying to monetize was also going through a transformation. And paid was, you know, paid media, which for us at Edelman was not a kind of a common thing that we do. We were mostly in the so-called earned media space. In other words, we work with reporters and the community to earn our way into their content.
Right.
But whereas a lot of companies obviously also, in addition, spend a lot on advertising, that wasn't really kind of a big capability for us. But as kind of the media began to look at new ways to monetize through what's called native advertising or sponsored content, which is kind of a reimagining of the editorial, which mirrors very similar types of monetization structures that are in other places like Google and Twitter and
mm-hmm.
Facebook, we, you know, a group of us felt we had to have a point of view on that, and so my goal was to kind of to accelerate that kind of point of view and help us recruit, you know, good talent and help us start to do new programs and find clients that were fearless and ready to try this. And certainly was involved with a lot of that. And now we have a team that's doing that, and it's part of our remit. And we're doing a lot more paid work. And we've done so in a way that hasn't jeopardized our core work in any way.
Right. I must say, Steve, you know, innovation is where it's at. And, people like yourself who think outside the box are critical to helping companies navigate transition as transformation happens more and more frequently in the industry. But I also realize that, and I'm sure you do too, that innovation and change are not always met with receptivity within an established company. So I'm sure that you had your share of challenges, even
our
with the remit
really
and the mandate
like
to drive this.
Yeah, our company's pretty good like that. We have, I'd like to say that we have 5,000 people in the firm and 5,000 people who innovate. And my role specifically is to kind of spot in really kind of one broad area, which is kind of content consumption.
Yeah.
What those and content kind of distribution, content flow broadly, what those disruptive opportunities, both from a threat, both in terms of a threat and an opportunity, are to our clients in the way that they do business,
mm-hmm.
and kind of plant the ideas and the seeds and sometimes conduct the research that starts the conversation. And then, you know, the network of people in the organization is very strong, and people figure out how to make money from it and figure out how to create new services for clients and figure out, you know, how to create new disruptive programs. And my job is to kind of be, you know, I like to be somebody who leads and assists, not points.
Right.
To be kind of the watch for what those opportunities are, and to, you know, sometimes start what are uncomfortable conversations. I mean, when we first started looking at native advertising and sponsored content, there were a lot of us who felt that was not a business that was right for Edelman for a lot of different reasons, and we had good, healthy debates about it. And now it's, you know, is it a giant part of our business? No, but it's something that we do, and we have a leader who's running that work. His name is Chris Paul. He's doing a great job. And it's part of our remit, and we're in the conversation. And we're also evolving our point of view through original research like we did in conjunction with the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which was a study of how consumers perceive the format. So, I'm fortunate in that the executive committee of Edelman distinctly makes me available to frees me up to do this kind of work. I mean, I don't run lines of business at Edelman. I don't run accounts. I work across a lot of different accounts, a lot of different clients, a lot of different opportunities, but my job specifically is to be smart about the market and to come in and to advise the senior leadership of Edelman what those opportunities are, and I think that's unique in a firm, firm like ours to do that.
I think it's a fantastic job that you have.
It is. It is, and it's. I'm very fortunate. And the thing I'm most fortunate about is the people I get to work with, because they truly are the smartest people in the business.
Yeah, I believe they are, among them. Now, speaking of being progressive, you put meditation as one of your top 10 suggestions for how others can develop this ability to see around corners and sort of thrive at the edge of innovation. What does meditation mean for you, Steve, and why do you think it's so valuable, personally and professionally?
Well, it's a work in progress for me. It's something being as you can tell, a bit of a fast-talking New Yorker, it's a little bit hard thing to do at times. and I can't, no one's going to call me the Zen master any day. But people who work around me certainly know that. I find that you need to step back and really try to see the big picture of things. And that's very hard to do when you're hurried. So the more you can, in sports, and I draw a lot of metaphors from sports, so forgive me if I alienate half the audience who doesn't care about sports, but, they talk about, kind of slowing the game down. And I find that meditation kind of helps you slow the game down a little bit, even if it's just for, and I admit I am, I'm not going off like Anderson Cooper did. And if you saw that's the slot he did on 60 Minutes on Mindfulness, where he went off into a place where he had to put his phone away for 3 days, and I think I'd go crazy. But
yeah,
but I'm able to do things, at 5 minutes a day, and that, I find that just helps me think through, kind of big. It just makes your mind clearer, and maybe it's all, maybe it's all just kind of I'm talking myself into it, but.
I want you to know I'm a proponent of it myself, and I know the difference it makes when I spend 10 minutes in a day and unplug to allow my mind to shift and relax than if I don't.
I would say in my case it's more mindfulness than it is meditation specific. I'm more aware of I like to be as aware as possible of my surroundings and what's going on. I'll give an example. The other day I was at JFK Airport, and it was a zoo. And somebody was buying a pack of M&Ms, and there was somebody who put down their iPad and she walked away, and I was aware, and there was a lot of visual clutter around. I was aware that she put her iPad down. She had totally no idea that she'd left her iPad right there at the counter, and I'm just kind of aware of things that are going on around me, and I think that that kind of practice makes me more aware, but I also think that makes me more aware in a macro sense of what's happening around me as it relates to content consumption and what the broader trends are. Could I do my job without it? Yes. But I think it's just kind of a step that helps.
Listen, I think you've said it very eloquently, and I get exactly what you mean, and I subscribe to the same theory. And as you and I know, kind of segueing to the next point, the media ecosystem that we immerse ourselves is in a constant state of flux. And you said before that content is no longer the only king. Could you elaborate on what you meant when you said that? And what are the other kings and implications that they have for partnerships moving forward?
Well, if you think about it, it used to be, and look, good content, great content always tends to rise to the top, so I'm not going to poo-poo that in any stretch of the imagination. But if you think about what the world was like, until fairly recently, you created something and you thought about how to distribute it, and sometimes even with a low budget, if it was really good, it would get discovered. And if it stood out. It would get discovered, and that's true in marketing as well, and certainly in PR. If you come up with a great strategy and you figure out how to communicate it, but there's now a new kind of layer of curation between content creators and the people who are the intended audience of that of those creations,
mm-hmm.
and those are largely algorithms. And it's largely algorithms from kind of two or three companies, notably from Facebook and from Google. And that's now kind of created a prism, if you will, between content creators and content consumers. And we don't have control over how those algorithms work. In some cases, we don't have a lot of insight, but we have to think about how those prisms take what's created and, you know, break it up into lots of different pieces and, you know, and to figure out what's going to make it through those filters, if you will.
Right, of course, including things like, you know, the distinction between one-directional content versus user-generated content and
right.
interactivity, right?
Yeah, and also, the especially with Facebook, something now that like 50 to 60% of all digital media consumption is taking place on mobile phones, and that's
mm-hmm.
And there's a small number of players there that dominate, and you have to understand how those players work. Now, could there be a shifting? Could it become more democratized over time? Possibly. But the history of the content creation process is make something and think about how to distribute it.
Right.
And be good. I think the new process is think about distribution first and have that guide what you create. Doesn't mean it should infringe on your creativity or your messages or what you want to say or your expression. But it needs to be factored in. So a company that's done that extraordinarily well is BuzzFeed. They have figured out how to really blend kind of news and memes together in a way that where the content finds you.
Yes.
And it's built their brand and to a point now where a lot of people now go to BuzzFeed directly, not through social, but you know, that's certainly that is distribution-centric thinking. And
to your point, I totally subscribe to that theory. In fact, 20 years ago when I was still driving music and entertainment initiatives at Apple, we came up with a campaign all around this aimed at content creators. We called it cross-media authoring within the context of a campaign called Masters of Media. And it was all about the notion that there would only be more devices and more points of distribution moving forward. Recognize this is 20 years ago now. And that when content creators would create a piece of new material, they should be thinking about all the places that their consumers would experience it. This is well before, you know, smartphones and tablets and everything else, but that's what the vision was. So I'm right there with you about thinking along those lines. And it really shifts the thinking of traditional content creators.
And it's changing every day, and it's a hard thing to really, you know, to try to understand. And a lot of it is now, like I said, driven by algorithms. I mean, Facebook makes one change to their algorithm, and overnight, media properties see traffic plummet and others rise.
That's right.
Google also, although I think the changes are a little bit slower than Facebook's changes.
Even YouTube, if you want to extrapolate Google to YouTube.
Oh, yeah. So understanding those platforms and look, believe me, I Steve Rubell and math are not phrases that are used in the same sentence, at least in a positive way.
Yeah,
but,
I got you.
Understanding at least how that works from a theoretical perspective and who's good at it, and really kind of understanding kind of the five best practices that you can pull in and do that is in. You borrow that from the pros. The marketers don't live and die by that, but content creators do.
Yes.
So that's a critical dynamic.
Well said. Now, Steve, I understand that you regularly share your insights, your wonderful insights and many faceted, on your blog and in your monthly column in Ad Age. And in a recent article, you talk about the digital decoupling of advertising and content business models, and argue that publishers can reshape the market if they essentially put them back together. Could you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Well, yes. So the history, you know, media in a physical form, the ads and the content travel together.
Right.
Right? So, you know, when you buy a newspaper, the ads are there, you can't cut them out. When you watch a TV program, you know, say pre-DVRs, pre-TiVo, the ads and the content were always together.
That's right.
And, you know, what some of the folks in the media industry have taught me is that now you could easily, you know, consume content, and the ads that you see with it are either not controlled by the publisher, they're controlled by a platform. As more ads are purchased through, like, tools like, you know, a lot of ads now are bought and sold through trading desks and done, you know, at bulk. So the experience changes, and also, you know, they're just, they're not necessarily consumed, you know, people buy, you know, they use ad blockers and things like that. So video is promising in the sense that the technology is at a point where the ads and the content have to travel together. So when you watch a video that's served up the correct, you know, in a way that's advertising supported, there's pre-rolls or there's overlays or there's interstitials or there's things that are where the ads and the content travel together. And no matter where you watch that video, the publisher makes money. So, and this was something that an executive at News Corp, Raju Narasetty, he kind of drilled into my head. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that, you know, when you watch a video from the Wall Street Journal, let's just say you're watching it on Facebook, they make money because the ad is shown with the content.
Right.
On the other hand, if you read an excerpt of a Wall Street Journal article on Twitter or through a Twitter card, or you see it on a blog, you know, or you stuff it in Instapaper, or you, you know, in some way use, you know, a browser with an ad blocker, you're not necessarily seeing an ad and the content travel together, or you're seeing, you could look at the same piece of content and see four different ads. So there's been this kind of decoupling of the two going together, and online video is kind of the one format where that sticks together, and I think you'll see innovations in I think the future innovations in kind of ad models and content models for media companies is thinking about how the articles and the ads travel together.
Well, now along those lines, I have to say something else I've been espousing when it's relevant with the right audience for the past decade. I'm sure you have some thoughts on this. Is the notion of contextually relevant advertising, so that in fact when I am watching a cooking show or thinking about remodeling my house, I'd see an ad for a Wolf stove and I wouldn't mind it. In fact, I'd welcome it.
I see a balance there.
Where is that headed?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you look at kind of retargeting on the internet, and, you know, so if you visit, you know, you visit a website, a travel website, and then suddenly you're on unrelated websites and you see banner ads from that same travel site, I think that spooks a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like,
you know,
Big Brother.
In a post-Snowden, you know, post, you know, Sony Pictures,
yep.
You know, post, you know, people are more aware of that stuff now than ever, and I think they're a little bit more spooked by it. So is it helpful? Absolutely. I mean, it's highly relevant, and it's targeted, and you know, the marketers love it. But the at the same time, I think consumers are maybe spooked by this as well, and it requires further study. So another group at Edelman is partnered with Cambridge, and they're doing kind of a large-scale study about consumer perceptions around big data and what their comfort level is around that,
mm-hmm.
As well as what the marketer perceptions are, and making sure that those two are aligned as closely as possible. And I think that also requires further study. And you could find, we haven't released that study yet, but we announced it, and you can find more information on our site.
Good to know. And yet, kind of back to this notion of decoupling and putting things back together, you've mentioned that the future of media may, in fact, be more distributed as publishers hedge their bets to avoid being burned. So what broader implications might this kind of risk aversion have on the media space in general?
Well, I think we're going to see kind of what I call more kind of like headless media companies, in the sense that, you know, the history of you know, media empire building has been come to us. Build, you know, we'll build great stuff. We'll hire great people who do great things, but you got to come to us. And the medium term and near term future of content consumption is, no, I'm going to go where I want to spend time, and your stuff has to come to me.
Right.
And news now needs to find me. And so, and you know what those dynamics look like could change, right? So obviously, you know, I mean, I'm not trying in any way to diminish what Twitter has done, but they, you know, comparatively to Facebook, they're small when it comes to news consumption.
Yes.
Could they overnight change things that makes them a force to be reckoned with that's larger than Facebook in terms of news consumption? Possibly. So that who's controlling that? I mean, certainly messaging apps right now are on the rise, and that's something to be watched. So what those means are, you know, certainly, you know, we know the devices are going to be personal. We know that that social and mobile together are going to be really important. Is the future of media kind of empire building something that lives on many different sites, many different places, but doesn't actually have a central deposit or isn't designed to kind of drive a lot of a traffic to one place, but designed to be ubiquitous? Now, obviously, part of that is requiring the monetization of that content and the content to travel together. There are some folks that are trying that. First Look Media, which is Pierre Omidyar's company, has an effort underway. I forgot the name of it. That's trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, and that's risky because you don't control your own destiny. You don't control the experience. You know, and a platform makes a change, and then you could see your fortunes decline overnight. But I wonder if people might try to figure out how to be in a lot of different places at once in a ubiquitous fashion, trying to get people to go to all one place, which is truly not an internet-friendly model. You know, distribution really works. Power of many, you know, things in many places works. Ubiquity works.
Well, personalization is a trend that is not going away in terms of consumers choosing what content they get in what format on their smartphones and tablets.
And this is hard. These are hard things. And I think the platforms will enable the publishers to do that really well. I mean, Facebook's made an effort to really teach publishers on how to make their content fit and how to get journalists, you know, creating content there. And it's been a bit of a struggle for them. LinkedIn's done a remarkable job of cultivating at first a group of influencers and then expanding out to a lot more publishers and many voices. And so this is a tough challenge. And mobile's a big catch-all phrase, but wearables are in the, you know, not even in the first inning. Tablets, I think, are more like the desktop environment. So I actually and if you look at the numbers, they're small. I mean, you know, we may see it around ourselves, but we're, you know, the number of tablet users is small. The number of smartphone users is huge,
right?
And around the world too. So, how, you know, looking at the top charts in the App Store for Apple and the top chart in Google Play and who's doing well is really important because, you know, is a company like Flipboard going to be a giant?
That's right.
Maybe not, you know. And there's new people that are experimenting there. Circa is experimenting with kind of this atomized content. There's a company called Nuzzle that's looking at, you know, how to bring content through social media. And so this is all a moving target. But one thing I do also is I look at what people around me have. I look at, like, I'm very bad in the sense that when I'm on a train or I'm on a plane or I'm on a bus, looking kind of what people are using, I'm not looking at what they're reading, but I'm just interested in what they're using. And the data points are good, but the anecdotal stuff is helpful as well because you see that you get to kind of connect the dots, and that's a hard thing to do.
You're always on, Steve. It doesn't sound like you relax too much, but
I do. This relaxes me. It relaxes me knowing answers, or at least having a good formulated response to tough questions people in my organization and my clients ask me.
Love it. That's why they pay you the big bucks. Now, here's a question kind of back to the future. I used to love the concept and the deployment of good advertorials. Is there still room for advertorials? You know what I mean? Like, mobile used to do these to try to bridge the gap.
Well, that's kind of what sponsored content and native advertising are. So the media business, the problem with the ad-supported media companies is that they, a lot of the marketers now want to buy and they want to buy ads through these kind of big trading desks. So what they do is they say, okay, you know, log in to eBay for ads, and I can buy a lot of impressions at a low price and, you know, bid for them and get a good deal across a lot of different sites and track the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been very, very good for marketers. But it's been very bad for media companies because the price of ads has declined because it's a market-driven phenomenon, and you know efficiencies have come in, and salespeople don't have to be utilized as much, and so forth. So, unfortunately, the media's costs continue to rise because they need high-quality talent for developing content and lots of new platforms to support, and there's a lot of more competition for attention. So, what they've done is they said, "Well, gee, if we look at what works in social media, Facebook has stories, and then they have sponsored stories, and Twitter's got tweets, and they got promoted tweets, and Google's got, you know, organic results and AdWords, and each one's a mirror image of each other. And if you look at the old advertorial, exactly the old mobile ads that they would run on the op-ed pages of the New York Times,
right,
and editorial, it's a similar model, at least in structure. So they've tried to move into what's called native advertising, which is basically allowing brands to publish or co-publish on their own on the media property sites in a very branded and overt way, but having that sit right next to editorial content. And you see this in lots of different places and lots of different media sites. And what we found is we've been looking at this for 2 years, and we wanted to have a kind of a point of view on it. What we found is that we think it's important to do, because paid now is required to stand out, because it's very difficult to get a message across given the fragmentation of media consumption. And there's some new opportunities that allow you to do that in a kind of a credible way, but it requires an editorial mindset. So our point of view on that is, yes, it's worth doing. No, it does not trump the value of a reporter or editor writing something in their own voice, in their own unattributed, unimpeded way.
Right.
But it can provide a nice context to it. And we've also looked at what does it take for that paid content to be successful. And we conducted a study of 5,000 people in conjunction with our friends at the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau. And they're a trade group that kind of helps publishers figure out what the next ad models look like. And we found out that if the content's relevant, if it's engaging, if it's high quality, it can work. And we have a full study on our website that kind of gets into that in much more detail.
Terrific. And as change becomes more rapid and pervasive and kind of the new normal, our daily lives become increasingly integrated with technology. Do you see or predict a return, Steve, to so-called old values?
Somewhat. I'm starting to wonder if private's the new public, in the sense that people are very aware of what they post on social media and how that shapes people's perception of themselves. And I'm wondering if they're just going to start to retrench in a little bit and move into kind of more closed networks. I don't see a full-blown move back to print, much as I don't see a big, giant move back to vinyl.
Right.
Although it's made a revival, but it's not a wide scale phenomenon. It's still a niche phenomenon. So, I think so. I think people. And look, I think there's a lot of events now, and people are some people are willing to give a lot to get a lot in return in terms of the data.
Mm-hmm.
Others are much more careful. I think the events of the last couple of years, whether it be Snowden or the recent Sony Pictures, have kind of made people stop and realize that you need to be aware of what's out there about you, and to be, many years ago, my first mentor in PR told me never put anything in an email that you don't want to see on the front page of the New York Times.
Right.
And now it's becoming, never put anything in anything that you don't want to see in the front page of the New York Times. So I think more and more people are becoming aware of that, but I don't see a return. I don't see a return necessarily to old technology, because I think that the march is still continuing, and the value is too great in what's being produced.
Oh, to be sure. And I didn't mean old technology as much as old values.
I don't think they went away. I just
yeah.
think that they were sometimes masked by this sense of new publicness, and everybody kind of sharing what's on their mind. And if you look at another, that's very much a U.S. phenomenon as well. I mean, if you look outside the United States, culture is very different in places like Germany or Korea or Japan. I mean, they're really, it's a different, it's, we tend to think that sometimes in the U.S. that that's the way it is
You're
worldwide.
Absolutely right.
It's really not. I mean, the cultures are very different.
We do get pretty myopic, and we've got to remember that it is a global world, and we have to factor in cultural variations. There's no doubt about it.
And we're small in comparison, yeah, in terms of the population
size.
You know, with all the people coming online from China and India and Africa, I mean, it's
yeah,
large.
It's a flat Earth these days, so we have to think about all that more than we ever have. Steve, do you have any other predictions for the immediate future media in 2015? What are some of the imminent disruptions that you see coming in the broader media landscape this year?
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, look, there's been a group of, I'm fascinated by this kind of group of media companies that we are calling digital natives. And some of them are quote-unquote older digital natives like, you know, Slate and even the Huffington Post now, I think, is coming up on 10 years or just past 10 years old, to, you know, new emerging media companies like Upworthy that are just, you know, kind of just on the cusp and you know, doing amazing things. And I think that really understanding how the digital DNA of those companies and what makes them tick, and a lot of them are venture-backed, and a lot of them are in this kind of ongoing traffic war with each other, and it's fueled by venture money, and it's fueled by social media traffic, and I wonder, on the other hand, they're as a group, they're incredibly powerful. So I'm really interested in kind of, does that trajectory continue, and are those companies able to thrive, and is there a shakeout, and do they consolidate? And already, you know, Gawker Media, again, great company, is beginning to change their strategy, and, you know, is that the right decision? Are they doing the right things? Are they shifting towards a model that's going to be indicative of where the others are going to go? And not to poo-poo the traditional media, because they also are really, you know, some of them are really good at accelerating into change. But I think consolidation in the media sector, whether it be with the large conglomerates or the new upstarts, we might see some unholy alliances. We might see
where the editorial is impacted once the acquisitions happen from larger entities.
They could, but I'm wondering if the little guys, if they're going to form kind of joint ventures, because everyone's in this race for surface area, and who's, you know, how do you scale in an era of infinite content and limited attention? So the digital natives seem to have something bottled up in really understanding the social web and the mobile web and how to you know, create content that's the right format for that, and reimagining the article and reimagining the ad.
Yeah.
Not that the bigger guys don't do that. They do. I mean, the New York Times and Time in particular have been two, and ABC are three brands that have been innovating, among many others, at breakneck speed. But I have to wonder if there's some consolidation, if there's going to be some kind of, you know, whittling down of all these different media companies, and if they all can't survive, and will we see more M&A this year, especially if the venture market continues to do well and the public markets continue to do well, I think there could be much more M&A activity.
I agree, and I see that trend myself, sitting where I do here in Silicon Valley and kind of watching.
I'm sure.
As you do.
Yeah.
So before we finish our chat, Steve, I always like to wrap up by asking my guests what I think is one of the most important questions of our time together, and frankly, that is, it's a legacy question. What comes next for you? What's the one project or collaboration you've not yet started that you dream about creating, whether with Edelman or beyond?
Well, I'm committed to being with Edelman. It's a great organization. It's world-class, and I'm privileged to be here, and I'm in a great role. So and the company is doing well, so I'm not going anywhere. And what I'm really looking at is my focus this year is on systems thinking and looking at kind of how marketers tend to divide projects up by type. You know, you got agencies that do digital work, and you got agencies that do media buying, and you got agencies that do creative work, and you got agencies that do PR. And you got, you know, marketing separate from communications in the corporate side. And a lot of that now is blurring because the Internet's a very blurry world. And obviously the consumption of content, as we just discussed at length, is blurring. And so I'm really focused on systems thinking and how we cultivate more of that here within the firm and also within our clients, because sometimes we're dealing with the communication side of the house, and sometimes we're dealing with the marketing side of the house. And one way I'm doing that is by kind of looking at, you know, getting, you know, having some new research that looks at kind of the seams between all these different ways people consume content, of specifically really looking at the what is the DNA of a social news story, and you know, who does that well, and what can we learn, and how do we make sure that we're creating best practices that mirror that. And so I would say it's systems thinking and holistic thinking, but, and you know, and then also leveraging different expertises and specialties and how those come together, which we have, we're fortunate to have here with a lot of depth.
Yeah, well, you, I tell you, you've certainly, you're in a pole position with Edelman. They're very fortunate to have you.
Yeah,
and
that's
I
too
think
nice.
That we all appreciate the contributions you're making to the industry at large in terms of your view and your vision and your strategic thinking. So thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to join us on this show tonight. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
A pleasure, Steve. And I want to thank, as always, our viewers, our listeners, rather. We're not on video yet. Wishful thinking.
Fortunate for you on my end.
But I do want to thank our listeners who join us here each week on the show for their attention and their devotion to our wonderful guests. And we'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.